Can new leadership get BlackBerry out of its jam?
And a defense of the private equity industry.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. You're listening to the Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. It is Monday, January 23rd.
Coming up, new European sanctions against Iran.
And the cloudy outlook for the solar industry.
Plus, the fortune for Chinatowns around the country. Beware the burbs.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
We start with Research in Motion, the company that makes BlackBerry phones. It's replaced its CEOs with Torsten Hines. The big challenge? The CrackBerry just isn't as addictive as it used to be. Or maybe more accurately, it's been replaced by other addictions. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So BlackBerry has been slowly losing out to iPhones and Android phones. How can the company recover from its slump?
Look, BlackBerry is sort of stuck in this chicken and egg situation. Right now, phone makers need apps to get people to buy their phones, and they need lots of users to get developers to make those apps. And according to the research firm Nielsen, BlackBerry is losing market share. Roger Kay of Endpoint Technologies is one of many tech analysts losing confidence with the company.
It's been going in the same direction for so long that it's hard to imagine it turning on a dime and doing something completely different.
So it has done something different today. It's got a new CEO. What can he do to really turn things around?
Some say it should just give up on competing with iPhone for the regular customers like you and me. It needs to go after big institutional buyers. Chris Green is a tech analyst with Davies Murphy, and he says BlackBerry is still popular with hospitals, law firms, not to mention government agencies. And the simple reason is security.
You can disable them the moment one gets lost, so we don't have instances of confidential information getting into the hands of wrong people. This is where BlackBerry is extremely strong, where it's stronger than the likes of Apple.
Or he says any other phones on the market. And he says that will keep BlackBerry around for the foreseeable future.
Marketplace's Jennifer Collins, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, for more on this story, we're going to take Research in Motion out of it and talk about the idea of a company being run by one of its co-founders, as Research in Motion was until today, versus a company being run by a new manager. For more, we bring in Julia Coronado, who's chief economist with BNP Paribas. She joins us from New York, as always. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, first, what is the advantage of a company being run by someone who's been there just a few years as opposed to one of the founders?
Well, when a company runs into strategic issues like Research in Motion has, the advantage of new blood can be a change in strategy, something that makes you more competitive. And that's regardless of whether you're replacing a founder or just management that wasn't taking the company in the right direction.
Is a founder good in ways that a new guy like Torsten Hines is not?
Well, it can be. Certainly the founder can bring passion and vision to a company that is quite unique. And here we think of Apple as the great example of this. And what happens when that passion and vision just rotates into a more regular business and a management team that sometimes is done very successfully and sometimes it's not?
Julia, one of the things that's sort of unusual about this Research in Motion situation is that they had two CEOs, co-CEOs. Does that hurt or help in management?
Well, I don't know. Again, there's no one clear answer. Look at Google. They had co-founders as well, and they've seemed to have worked that out rather well. So I don't think that there's one size fits all when it comes to one versus two.
Julia Coronado, chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas. Thanks, as always.
It's a pleasure.
The year of the dragon starts today. It's considered the luckiest in Chinese astrology. And Chinatowns around the U.S. are going to celebrate with firecrackers, parades. Those Chinatowns remain symbolically important to Chinese Americans, but not as many are calling them home. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
The largest Chinese population in New York used to be in Manhattan's Chinatown. Now it's across the East River in Queens. The same thing is happening in Chinatowns from San Francisco to Seattle to Boston.
The importance of traditional Chinatown as residential neighborhoods has been declining for some time.
Wei Li is a professor of Asian American Studies and Geography at Arizona State University. She says nearly three-quarters of Chinese immigrants have come to the U.S. in the last two decades. The existing Chinatowns were too small to accommodate that growth. And says Wei Li, there's been a socioeconomic shift in those immigrants, too.
Many of them are wealthy as well as armed with higher education degrees.
And want to buy a house in a good school district. So they head to the burbs. Wei Li says traditional Chinatowns still have a role catering to lower income immigrants, older residents, and tourists. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Well, the Chinese New Year isn't just a cause for celebration. Feng Shui masters are using the ancient Chinese art and their knowledge of this Year of the Dragon to predict economic trouble in the year ahead. According to one Feng Shui master, there isn't much to look forward to. In today's Midday Extra, the BBC's Kate McGough reports from London.
Today we're entering the Year of the Water Dragon. So according to Feng Shui masters, we should be watching out for floods and other natural disasters involving water that could damage the global supply chain. The dragon is believed to be especially lucky, and many couples across Asia are making an extra effort to give birth to dragon babies. But even the economy can't escape predictions from the elements in the Chinese zodiac, and a year of the water dragon is not good news there. If the stock market is influenced by the collective mood of the people, then a water year is bad news. In Chinese mythology, water is the element that makes people afraid and depressed, so we shouldn't expect a strong recovery. But according to Feng Shui master Raymond Lowe, it's not all bad news.
Water means money. So that means we see some prospect of improvement in American economy.
And according to Raymond, people want change in water years to wash away old-fashioned beliefs. So there should be more protests and government changes in the year ahead. In London, I'm the BBC's Kate McGough for Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
The European Union this morning formally adopted an oil embargo against Iran. The embargo applies immediately to new oil deals and allows existing deals to run through July. The sanctions also target other aspects of Iran's economy, like the central bank and gold trading. And it's one in a series of sanctions against the country over its nuclear program. From where we go now to Jonathan Marcus. He's the BBC diplomatic correspondent in London. Good morning.
Good morning.
So there are already American sanctions, international sanctions. What's new with these?
Well, what's crucial about these is that the Americans have tried to constrain Iran's oil industry, but of course America itself doesn't buy oil from Iran. The Europeans do. Some European countries are heavily dependent upon Iranian oil. Greece buys about a third of its imported oil from Tehran. Italy and Spain buy a little over 10% of their oil from the Iranians. So cuts here will have a significant impact on Iran's economy.
Now, you just mentioned Greece and Italy. We know they're in some economic trouble. Could this sanction end up hurting them as well?
Well, potentially it could, and I think that's why the European Union has decided to phase in the sanctions. There will be no new contracts with the Iranians from now on, but existing contracts will continue to run until July. And I think this phased approach towards the sanctions is clearly intended to allow countries like Greece, Italy and Spain, which you rightly say are amongst the weaker elements of the European Union at the moment, to get alternative supplies elsewhere. Of course, nobody wants to see an oil crisis, which on the one hand would greatly complicate Europe's economic difficulties and all of the problems around the euro and so on. But equally, a significant increase in the oil price would paradoxically, of course, benefit Iran as well.
Jonathan Marcus is the BBC's diplomatic correspondent in London. Thanks so much.
Great pleasure.
The exit polling from South Carolina shows the upset victory by Newt Gingrich over the weekend is thanks in part to a new campaign narrative by Gingrich and his supporters, a narrative that attacks Mitt Romney's time at the private equity firm Bain Capital.
Mitt Romney became CEO of Bain Capital the day the company was formed. His mission? To reap massive rewards for himself and his investors.
Mitt Romney, them guys, they don't care who I am.
Well, Mitt Romney's campaign is already running an ad in Florida to counter that narrative and highlight the economic upsides of private equity. We are going to talk about the private equity industry now with an industry leader. Adam Blumenthal is the founder and managing partner of the private equity firm Blue Wolf, and he's with us from New York. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, let's start with what it is that you do, which has come under attack recently. Describe to me what it is that a private equity guy like yourself does.
Well, Jeremy, What we do is look for companies which have a complicated set of problems, that maybe they have gotten out of touch with their market or they're underperforming in some other way. And we use capital which pension funds primarily have entrusted to us, mixed with our own money. And we buy those companies and we work over a 3 to 5 to 7 year period of time to try to turn them around, have the companies become more valuable, and ultimately we sell them to somebody who will be a long-term owner.
And do you care in that process if the company ultimately survives or not?
We care very much. Usually the companies that our firm buys, their long-term future is not at all certain when we get there. And what our business is and our goal is to make those companies grow, make them thrive, fix their problems, and have them be long-term survivors.
It does seem that a lot of the criticism that's been directed at the private equity industry is because it seems some private equity people don't have employment in mind. They don't care if the company that comes out on the other end has 100 employees or 50.
Well, what any management team or what any set of owners really want to do is make the company grow, thrive, and be more valuable. In general, when you do that, employment grows, but not always. We sometimes get involved with companies which have had their sales fall in half and nobody's adjusted the employment. And the reality is you can't survive. And if you want to survive, you have to get things lined up.
Do we need private equity in this economy, or is it just something that speeds up the process of fixing companies that are not doing that well? Do we need it or not?
We do need it. Many companies that we've seen, they can't adapt to change quickly enough, or the short-term focus of quarterly earnings leads to an inability to make decisions that are important for the long run. And for companies in those kinds of situations, they'll never get fixed unless somebody like us gets involved and organizes things appropriately.
What do you make of the criticism being called vulture capitalist or barbarians even?
I think that it's easy to find examples of anything that any industry does that didn't work out well. I think the overwhelming reason that pension funds and universities and the sovereign wealth funds all over the world invest in private equity is we're able to, by focusing on very specific niches, make companies be worth more than they were before. In general, our economy is better because people are focused on doing that.
Adam Blumenthal is founder and managing partner with Blue Wolf Capital Partners, a private equity firm. Adam Blumenthal, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Now to one of the sweetest news stories of the day, or maybe bittersweet or semi-sweet. Chocolate. The price of cocoa has started to fall. And from London, Christopher Worth explains why.
Karsten Fritsch is a commodities analyst for Commerce Bank. He watches the cocoa markets closely and he enjoys his work.
Yes, I like eating chocolate.
But lately, fewer chocolate lovers are buying sweets. And there's a very simple reason for that. Demand for cocoa, the main ingredient in chocolate, has dropped across the world as the global downturn drags on. And Fritsch says with less demand, the price of cocoa has plunged.
So there's a visible effect of the economic crisis on cocoa demand. But I think that the main driver is the supply situation.
That is, the supply of cocoa that's grown around the world. Growers had expected a surplus of cocoa this year, but dry, dusty winds out of the Sahara now threaten crops in West Africa, the world's largest region for production, a scenario that could send cocoa prices right back up again and keep chocolate lovers away too. In London, I'm Christopher Worth for Marketplace.
Well, you know, Adrian, a lot of people who work in offices are eating more chocolate these days, and they're also drinking more coffee. That's according to a new study out of the United Kingdom, which finds 25% of office workers are extremely bored, and they're increasing their chocolate and coffee intake at an alarming rate. But if you find yourself bored at work, be careful what you wish for, because researchers say one quick way to curb that boredom is to give you more work.
Now to Anaheim, California, where musicians, record producers, and music teachers gathered this weekend at the National Association of Music Merchants, or NAMM, trade show. You'd think a convention featuring musical instruments would be pretty controversy-free. I mean, they're instruments. But as Marketplace's Eve Tro reports, some guitars are creating quite an environmental hubbub.
In the Martin Guitar booth at the NAMM trade show, players reverently picked up the instruments on display. Some cost tens of thousands of dollars. What makes them so precious? Often the wood. Much of it's rare or endangered.
That's mahogany. That's ebony.
George Gruen runs Gruen Guitars in Nashville.
Each wood has its own sound and its own function in the guitar.
And each kind of wood has to be listed, genus, species, and country of origin, if you want to export that guitar. That's been the rule since 2008, part of the Lacey Act to curb trade in endangered trees. Gruen says dealers like him are nervous about that law these days, because last year the federal government raided Gibson guitars and seized pallets full of rosewood and ebony of questionable origin. Ann Middleton is with the Environmental Investigative Agency. Her group tracked that wood from Madagascar.
The fact that when it crossed U.S. borders happened to be in the hands of Gibson guitars was out of our control. We did not target the music industry.
Nevertheless, some music makers feel attacked. Their trade group, NAMM, is now lobbying to rework the law.
Not to create any special rules, just to see clarity.
Mary Lewerson directs government policy for NAMM. She says other industries like paper, furniture, and flooring import much more wood than instrument makers.
And I think the fear is really around other interests piling onto our legislative fix.
Environmental groups say NAMM's efforts to make exceptions could open the door for other industries to skirt the law. Madagascar-born musician Razia Saeed sang outside the NAMM show in protest. She says only strict trade laws can protect forests in her home country because the Madagascar government is in chaos.
People cutting wood from national parks. Just imagine if people would go to Yellowstone and just cut some trees.
She says even if the music industry is not the main culprit, it should do all it can to set a good example. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
The solar industry has hit a bit of a dreary patch. Think double-digit stock price drops and analyst downgrades. The world's biggest solar market, Germany, is backing off a little, and there are other clouds on the horizon. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
It sounds weird, but solar actually did too well in Germany. As a new energy source, it got generous subsidies. But the environment minister says the plan got too popular and broke the subsidy bank. Martin Siemenek works at Bloomberg New Energy Finance.
It's very obvious, especially in the south of Germany. Bavaria is possibly almost all covered by now with modules.
So they're taking away the solar punch bowl. Subsidies will phase out quickly and sales will slow. Strike two for the $82 billion industry is the U.S. market. American firms have sued Chinese competitors over unfair pricing. Jesse Pichel at investment bank Jefferies expects that will lead to tariffs and higher prices all around.
Higher priced solar panels means at least some projects in the U.S. will not get done.
It doesn't help that a key competitor, natural gas, is at its lowest price in a decade. But down the road, Pichel sees a vast solar market globally. Long-range forecast? Partly sunny. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
And finally, Jeremy, last week you heard about the leap second, which
right.
is a second of time we add to our calendars to keep our clocks basically in sync with the Earth's rotation. And a UN group was going to decide if we should keep it or dump it. We heard the story from Stacy last week. It was pretty interesting. Apparently, this second really messes with satellite navigation systems,
yep.
among other things. Turns out that group couldn't come to a decision, so they put it off till 2015. Which is a pretty massive procrastination, at least in relative terms. That's more than 94 million seconds in 3 years, all over a second of time. In Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.